What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride.
Oh, hey.
Hey,
hey!
Dr.
Hey! Hello, hello, hello. Is there anybody out there?
What happened to Zoom when you need it?
I know. I'm so sorry for the trouble.
I have no idea what happened, but that's okay.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to come here.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you.
Now, is it, because we've heard it pronounced a couple different ways. Is it Dr. Shutt?
Yeah, how about Bill is good as well.
Shut.
Okay.
Yep. Like the door.
Very good.
So, Bill, is this your first time kind of overlapping with the true crime community?
No, I mean, the book came out in 2017. And, you know, in my household now, cannibalism is the gift that keeps on giving because I'm still getting interviews. I was just on... The Unexplained with William Shatner, and that's like four or five years after the book came out. So it's it's a topic that the interest in it just hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
So I've been lucky enough, and just incredibly lucky, to have picked that topic, and you know, I guess to look at it in a way that hadn't been done before,
right?
And so, you know, since then I've written. You know, I just finished my second book after Cannibalism, and that's coming out in August. That's on Teeth. But the style is there, basically demystifying a topic that, you know, most people have these preconceived notions about, and, you know, to be able to look at it from a different angle. But I've served to make a long story longer.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly gotten a lot of questions about criminal cannibalism and things like that. And I'm not an expert on that stuff. I have a rough idea of what it is. To me, it's a spectrum of, it's on a spectrum of psychological disorders, and I'm not the person to talk to about that. And then when I started this book and doing the research, I just wanted to stay away from the sensationalism and gore that, and there was plenty of that out there.
Right.
And in a sense, I was very lucky about that as well, because there were all of these books about cannibalism, and it was like a gore fest,
right.
And it was Jeffrey Dahmer, and it was just, the list goes on and on. And then on the other side, there were these academic, mostly scientific papers, a couple of books that were out there looking at cannibalism in the animal kingdom, mm-hmm. for example. But they were academic. They were written for scientist types,
right.
who were interested in the specific types of animals that were doing the cannibalism.
Right.
There was nothing in the middle, so I just kind of walked through there and used the same technique that I had done in my first book on vampirism, and just take something that people think that they, you know, when they've got a knee jerk reaction,
right.
to it, and to look at it beyond that, and so I chose not to spend a lot of time. Looking at criminal cannibals, although truth be told, I started the book with, you know, Psycho, which is one of my favorite movies,
mm-hmm.
and then talked about the real life murderer behind,
mm-hmm.
that. But I really didn't get into the, I didn't get it. I just made a decision that I didn't want to glorify in some people's minds that might still be alive. Maybe they're in prison. Maybe their loved ones are still alive, that they were victims. And I just didn't want to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I stayed away from it. And that's why I had the reaction that I did to the initial questions that you had. You know, I realized that you've got a blog site about crime, mm-hmm. but you know, hopefully I can provide something a little bit different as far as a background, mm-hmm. for your readers that it's not just about criminal cannibalism. It's not just about starvation,
right.
You know, the guys up in the Andes or
the Donner
Party.
Right.
That was the one that I did get to explore once again, got really lucky because there were, you know, I thought that that was a topic where that everything had been done. Uh-huh. And when I started the book, there were these headlines saying that, oh, you know, there's proof now that the Donner Party didn't cannibalize. And I was like, oh, really? And I started to investigate and talk to researchers who were actively working on the Donner Party. Uh-huh. And they were, you know, they were shaking their heads and going, no, there was cannibalism in four different places. And it there's no doubt that it took place. It was just a screw up by a PR department of a college put out, you know, they misinterpreted some early results that one of their research had come up with. And from there, the newspapers got a hold of it and boom, it was like, you know, cannibalism, you know, but, and that takes a long time to get out of the public mind once you get that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Bill, first of all, like, I'm so glad you're saying all of this because kind of to give you just a little bit, I have two things to say that I'm excited about. The first thing is, so that is a lot of the things that's a kind of a mission with Bailey and myself is we're seeing so much of just falsified information, misinformation, especially in true crime. You know, this genre has exploded and we're like, but hold on, this is very unethical, right? And so that's why we have really been wanting to research and, you know, reach out to professionals like you to say, like, not only is it just our opinion that this is not good information, but here are people that are way smarter than we are who can back this up.
Well, I don't know about
that. And the second thing that I'm really excited about is I'm actually a dental hygienist. And so you writing a book on teeth is like, ooh, it makes me all tingly. I'm super excited about this.
Yeah, Bite is coming out on August 13th. And I'm really excited about it. My last book was punk, but it was about the heart, and it worked out well, and there was some really interesting stuff. But when I started to work on teeth, I just found that there was just so, you know, to me it reminded me of cannibalism, and that there were so many things to look at and explore and research that I was really excited writing the thing, and I do think it came out. It might be my best book. It's got the best cover ever.
I'm excited for you.
Personally, I'm very excited to read anything like that, because like I said, I've been a dental hygienist since 2007, so I've spent pretty much my adult life dealing with the ins and outs of teeth. But I'll digress, because today we're not here to talk too much about teeth.
Maybe next time we'll talk about teeth.
Right. And Bill, how did you find yourself writing a book about cannibalism? How did you find yourself, you know, going down that road?
Well, let's see. When I was going for my PhD, at Cornell, I was looking around for someone to work with, and the guy that I wound up having as my PhD advisor and mentor, John Hermanson, his grant money was basically came from studying horses and horse musculature, and he worked at the vet school at Cornell. Mm-hmm. But I think his real passion, from a research point of view, was were bats, and so as someone who grew up with every weird animal, when I was a kid, I had a monkey, I had a boa constrictor, pythons, every lizard that you can think of. And I was always looking under rocks and capturing things and letting them go. And so I'd always been into animals, and I'd always been into bizarre, you know, I'm a real horror movie buff. And so when I started to work for John at Cornell, it's probably took 2 minutes to decide that I didn't want to work on horse musculature. I'd much rather work on bats. And then within the bats, the bats that most interested me were vampire bats. So that became my research for the next 5 years. And that literally, I got once again, very, very lucky. Got a wonderful agent in New York City who was interested in having me write a book. And initially it was going to be about vampire bats, but then we spread it out and decided to do Dark Banquet, which was about blood feeding in nature. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of slid into historical practices with blood and what our early beliefs were mm-hmm. about what it was mm-hmm. And you know, where it came from. And, you know, we're still seeing that stuff now with, you know, this controversy with illegal aliens are destroying the blood of our of America.
Yeah. Right.
You know, some ridiculous crap still goes
right.
on. So from that book, when that book came out, of course, that you're like, okay, what are you going to write next? And from vampirism, it was a short jump to thinking, all right, well, let me write a book about cannibals.
Right.
And there was nothing out there from a scientific viewpoint that also, you know, I've also really been interested in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was an easy, you know, it was an easy transition and one that I'm very happy that I made. You know, that's the by far my most successful book, and it's still doing really well. And so I guess I had the background in an interest in the macabre and also strange animals mm-hmm. So it was pretty easy to make, to slide into writing that type of book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I think in my bubble, that is not something that interest in the macabre and cannibalism is not going to go away, because at the junior high that I spend a lot of time working with, literally we watched a video that covered the Donner Party in one of the U.S. history classes. And in seventh grade, you read this book series, or excuse me, a book entitled How They Croaked. And it's how famous, whether it's authors or historians or public political figures throughout the history, have died. And it's quite explicit and quite graphic, and the kids absolutely love it. It's done in a very tasteful way. But I say that to say, I think it is something that people are just kind of naturally drawn to. And
yeah.
I'm very thankful that we have professionals like you who can bring a very tasteful, a very ethical approach, you know, a research-based, as opposed to it just being, like you said, and we tend to find this word popping up in our podcast a lot, sensational, right? Yes,
yep.
People do love sensational things. Don't get us wrong. We all love it a little bit. But you can't just leave it at sensational. You've got to bring a richness to it. And so that's...
Yeah, you've also got to get rid of the jargon as well. Yeah. And that's something that I really... And I think that came from teaching. I was a college professor for 25 years or so,
uh-huh.
and I was always interested in bringing everybody along in the classroom.
Yes.
Not the smartest students.
Yes.
But in order to do that, you've got to be entertaining. You've got to use humor, and you've got to be able to hit your main points in a way that is understandable.
Right.
And so that just carried over to the way I write. So I think that's important as well. It's you need to be able to, when you write this type of book, and you know, not just me, but I think that scientists sometimes have a problem. I don't want to say getting down to the level of, but interpreting complex scientific phenomenon into something that is understandable
yes.
for someone who's not a scientist.
Correct.
You know, that to me that's something that I always concentrate on. It's right there as far as I'm concerned with the most important thing that I try to do when I write.
And making it relatable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that way we can understand it. And I think part of the reason why things become, you know, gory or sensationalized is it's stimulating, right? But if you can make it stimulating in a way, in a different way, then almost from a neural perspective, we don't crave that stuff as much, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, with cannibalism, you have food plus the maybe the number one taboo. You put those together, and now everyone's fascinated by that. And it's, you know, it's not. I don't think it's going to go away. Apparently, it hasn't.
So,
been
speaking of food, Bill.
Uh-oh.
Do you want to guess where I'm going with your House of Speakeasy clip that I recently watched in your invitation to Plano, Texas?
Yeah, that was a trip. You know, I write the thing as well. I've written three novels, and if I could have sat there and just written the story of what happened to me going down there, it couldn't have been any weirder, any more poignant, any more interesting, and just completely unpredictable.
What happened to you in Plano? Do we want to unpack this box?
Yeah. They'll open this refrigerator door. Cannibalism was pretty much written, and I was about to start my semester at Long Island University. And I read this article in the New York Times that talked about placentophagy, where midwives and other people would obtain the placenta from a woman who had just given birth, and they would prepare it for her in various ways. And that by consuming her own placenta, that she could treat the baby blues, that you could, in a sense, replace the hormones that have been lost when you lose your placenta. And so I contacted the world's only expert on placentas, and he was a professor up in Buffalo, and he gave me a couple of names. And when I followed up, I got into contact with this woman who did this for a living. And she would go to the hospital, she would get the placenta from her customer, and then she'd bring it back to her house. And she had all of these different ways that she could prepare it. You know, you could, you know, in a sense, you could dry it out like you were doing beef jerky, and then powder it, and then put it into, fill in the blank, orange juice or milk. Or you could make a Slurpee out of it. She would prepare it in all of these different ways. And I started to talk to her on the phone. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a really cool phone interview. And we got about halfway through it. And she goes, well, too bad you can't come down to Plano. You could eat my placenta. And I just went. She goes, yeah. I gave birth recently, and I've got my placenta in the refrigerator. Of course, you can't.
But I would be happy. What's mine is yours. What is it? Mi casa, yeah. Su casa, Bill. Just come on down to Texas.
Now head on down. So I'm thinking to myself. First of all, it was completely unexpected. I got to thinking that. So I'm writing a book about cannibalism, and I'm writing this section about placentophagy, and then I don't go down to Plano, Texas to consume this woman's placenta, or at least to try it.
What kind of researcher would you be?
10 years from now, if I'm reading this book, I'll be kicking myself in the ass.
I have a feeling you're not going to get very many offers like this, Bill. I'm pretty sure that this is not a weekly offer basis.
True, thankfully. But anyway, make a long story short, I came home and told my wife about it. Then probably 15 minutes later, I had plane tickets to go down to Plano. And that the trip in itself is crazy because there was a serious windstorm the night that I get down there. Also, Ebola had hit in the United States right there, right then. And people were quarantined. There was a really weird vibe. Plus, Plano is a suburb of Dallas. And since I was a little kid, I've been a Kennedy assassination buff, and I read everything about it. And so I'd never been to Dealey Plaza. I'd never been down there. And so I did that the day before I met her. And when I did it, it just got weirder and weirder. She had 10 homeschooled kids, and her daycare couldn't come that day because they had no power up until right before I got there. So all of her kids were there, and they were, no, they were really, really nice, but there were 10 kids, and I'm trying to talk about, why your mother cooks placentas
and is offering it to the author of a cannibalism book, right?
Oh yeah. Her husband comes out; he's got a chef's outfit on, and he's like, "We can cook this any way you want it. You could have it in a taco. We can make it asabuco." I'm like, Italian background. I'll go with the asabuco.
It's like a Seinfeld episode, almost like a really morbid Seinfeld.
Yep. You have no idea. So these kids are like all over me. And if you've ever seen Raising Arizona,
we love that movie.
Where Nicolas Cage goes into the bedroom and he goes back out to describe what just happened. He goes, "It was horrible. They were like climbing all over me. I couldn't." And that's the way, these kids were like all over me.
You better get that placenta, Bill. Don't you come back out here without that placenta now.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm interviewing her on the front lawn because that's the only way that she could get away from all of her children. And they're pressed up against the window. And it was just, so then his husband and one of the kids goes off on a bicycle to go to Target, I think, to get the essentials for this placenta prep that she's going to do. She's preparing, she's going to show me how she prepares the customer's placenta. She's making artwork out of it. She takes it and spreads the thing out and puts food-based paints on it, and then takes it and plops it onto this heavy-duty art stock and makes, so you have a choice. You're a customer. You can either make it into a balloon with the umbilical cord being the string, or you can make one with a flower.
Chelsea had to mute her mic. She's laughing so hard.
This happened. So the long story short, he comes back with all of the gear that he needs, which is like, you know, diaper pads to lay out so she can, you know, have a clean surface, and garlic. Meanwhile, I've gone off before I get there to a liquor store in Plano, Texas. And I'm like, all right, I got to find the most Texas looking person that I can find working here. And I find this with cowboy boots, the whole nut. And I'm like, well, I've got an interesting pairing tonight. I hope you can help me with. I need to get some wine for dinner. So she's like, yeah, what? And I'm like, I tell her. And she literally runs away. And so I'm standing there and I figured, all right, well, I'll just grab a bottle of Italian red, pay, and went off to this person's house. So they prepared an ossobuco. And so he's steaming these vegetables. And he looks at me and he goes, these vegetables are all organic. And I'm like, well, they can, thank God, because there's no chance that I'm eating your wife's placenta if the vegetables are not organic. So she goes to the refrigerator. She gets this tiny, very small piece of placenta, which is her placenta. And
Does she ration that placenta out? Were you only, she only had a square to spare there?
We had a small piece. That's all I was worth. And so after the vegetables are sweated and cooked, he puts the placenta in and cooks it up and plates it. So I've got this like series of photographs of me eating this. And the thing about placenta
tastes like chicken, I'm
and
sure.
A lot of other meats, it tastes like, it's like chicken. But I mean, it tastes like anywhere that you prepare it, anything that you put with it is what it tasted like. And he was a chef and he knew what his style, and he used some of the red wine that I brought. And it came out really well. And it was a small portion of it. And I ate it just so that I could say that I did. But I would never condone it. First of all, because you can, I mean, if she were ill, if she had some type of a communicable disease, I could have gotten it. So it's not something that I would ever recommend. I did it for the sake of, you know, having, you know, writing a book about it and investigating from that angle. But even talking to her, you know, she brought up this old, I think it was a European article that all of these people sort of walk around with when they talk about the benefits of consuming your own placenta. And, you know, if you're trying to replace your hormones, a hormone is a protein. Mm-hmm. If you take a protein and cook it, and you can look at that when you do, if you, you know, use, it's like a chicken egg and the albumin in a chicken egg, if you cook it, it's not albumin anymore. Mm-hmm. You've denatured this protein. And it's exactly the same thing if you were to take a placenta, cook it, and then expect to get some type of, you know, hormone boost from it. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
And she had as much as admitted that, but we both agreed that, you know, that the placebo effect is very strong. Mm-hmm. And that to me works. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're getting a benefit from this, then oftentimes you do. But as far as any type of medical benefit, I've never read anything at all. Not one iota of data,
right,
that it worked.
Oh.
It's a very small group of people that do this. It's really the last vestiges of medicinal cannibalism, and now it's a, you know, a form of alternative medicine practiced mostly by middle class white women in the United States. That's not found, you know, in it's like
anywhere else.
I must eat it in China. I'm like, no, they don't eat it in China. So yeah, it was really, really interesting. And I stayed in touch with her. They did not have a lot of money. And so I wound up befriending her and I would send like a big box of Christmas things to her kids for a couple of years. And then we lost touch, but she was a really nice person. And so was he. And so were her kids. It was a strange experience.
Yeah.
Now, Bill, like I said, kind of referencing back to that House of Speakeasy that I heard you speak with, you talked about that there was a wave of cannibalistic practice in the United States, kind of in the hippie movement. Did I hear that correctly?
That's where, I wouldn't call it that.
Okay.
I mean, you're talking about placentophagy.
Okay,
here.
So you were specifically talking about placentophagy.
Yeah. Okay. When I looked to see where this came from, you know, who was doing this? And it seems like it started with in the late 70s.
Okay.
Sort of late hippie movement, but it wasn't medicinal. It was a matter of sort of like sharing among the group. But I wouldn't term it as cannibalism.
Gotcha.
Not at all. Not by any stretch.
Okay.
You know, to me, this was the origin of this idea that you could get some type of a benefit from consuming your placenta. And this, from what I understand it wasn't just women. It wasn't just the person who had given birth. It was something like he was a commune and you're sharing these things among each other. I think that was from what I had read and what I was explained to by this expert, this guy in Buffalo, that was the origin of placentophagy. But there was I'd never heard of a widespread cannibalism, anything in the United States.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
And just to kind of jump right in, what would you say are kind of starting off this conversation about cannibalism? I don't think that any interview is ever going to top how we just started this interview. Okay. So you definitely made your mark there. But what are some of the kind of major misconceptions from your perspective about cannibalism?
There were really two that came out of my work on the book, and one had to do with the animal kingdom. And that was at least the first half of the book. And that was this misconception that if cannibalism took place in the animal kingdom, that it was really rare. And most people would point to praying mantises and black widow spiders or stressful captive conditions. And those were the reasons behind that you'd see any cannibalism in the animal kingdom. And that just turned out to be not even close. Cannibalism was incredibly widespread across the entire animal kingdom, much more common in some groups than others. But it happened for reasons that were perfectly natural. For example, parental care as a lifeboat strategy to keep some of the young alive, as a hedge against unpredictable environmental conditions, as a reproductive strategy. And there were so many examples of this that to me was the big revelation to me that cannibalism existed in the animal kingdom for reasons that went so far beyond what most of us, including myself, believed that it did.
It's interesting.
That was the biggie. And the other was with human cannibalism. Here you're talking about, you know, since the time of the ancient Greeks and then into the Romans and then throughout Europe, this snowball effect that cannibalism is the greatest taboo. I mean, you could argue that it's not, and there's probably things you could think of that might be worse than that. But in any event, throughout the West, you know, to me, it was considered to be the just about the worst thing that you could do to another person. And incredibly widespread, that thought, throughout Europe, throughout the United States. And then to find out that for hundreds of years in Europe, that medicinal cannibalism existed, and every part of the human body, just about everything you can think of, was consumed in all sorts of ways to treat anything, any malady or psychological or medical problem that, you know, people were treated for drowning by trying to have them drink blood. And there's just like this list of stuff that went on in all of the classes, from the richest royalty down to the poor people, for hundreds of years. And that just blew me away, given the cannibalism taboo.
Right.
And it lasted right up into the 20th century. Yeah, the Merck Index had mumia ground up mummy, a complete mistranslation by someone who thought that there was medicinal benefit to consuming mummies. So that to me was, you know, that blew me away. You know, those are the biggies. How widespread it was in animals, and just the fact that medicinal cannibalism lasted for hundreds of years, from the Middle Ages right up into the turn of the 20th century.
Hmm. So it sounds like kind of what I'm hearing you say is that from that perspective, from a, for lack of better words, evolutionary standpoint, that the concept of cannibalism really at least fell under the kind of medicinal umbrella, and that it is fairly normal.
I mean, I don't think evolution and medicinal cannibalism really have anything to do. And the reason is, when you get into humans, you're dealing with culture. Mm-hmm. and culture is king.
Mm-hmm.
Culture dictates what is right and what is wrong as far as behavior. So if you're a Westerner and you've been, and since the time of the ancient Greeks, there has been all of this literature that's been building and building and building through Rome, through Europe, through fairy tales that cannibalism is horrible, that then cannibalism is horrible. But if you haven't gotten that memo, if your group believes that consuming the bodies of the dead that you, and you love these people, is sacred, then cannibalism is a good thing. So, you know, I'm not sure I answered your question, but that, you know, that to me is, you know, there's a real difference there between cannibalism in fish, who are, it's not like when a codfish drops 5 million eggs and it consumes some of them. It's not, well, that's Jerry and there's Betty and this is Janie. Over here. This is easily accessible food. There's no sort of thought about, is this right or wrong? But once you get into humans, then you're dealing with something very different, very different. And, you know, so I don't think that there's a real difference between what you see in nature and, for example, someone who decides that, you know, eating someone's going to cure some specific disease. So I'm not sure about tying that together. I do think that throughout the animal kingdom, cannibalism has evolved as a natural behavior for a bunch of reasons. And I go through and talk about different examples of those. You know, when you get to humans, it's a matter of what's evolved behavior in humans that relates to cannibalism. If you're in a starvation condition, whether you are in a besieged city like Leningrad during World War II, or it's the Donner Party, or it's these guys that whose plane crashed in the Andes, then when your body is starved to the point where there's nothing else to eat and there's no alternative, then you are either going to choose to consume the dead or feed them to your children to try to keep them alive, or you're going to die. That is, there is that sort of survival instinct that we have. But it is one, you know, there were people in the Donner Party who chose to starve to death. They did not consume bodies of the fellow pioneers. So to me, that's, you know, I don't think that there's a gene for cannibalism in humans. I've never seen any evidence of any of that. I think that criminal cannibalism lies on a spectrum. There are reasons why people carry out this type of behavior. And there's a lot of kinky people out there, and you know, that certainly can fall into the realm of cannibalism. Mm-hmm. If people are doing it for that reason.
Yeah.
Bill, do you worry, and maybe this is just a really dumb question, but do you ever worry with, like, you know, what was it, Netflix that just released that huge Dahmer series, you know, and everybody's watching it, and it's really just a hot buzz topic type of thing. Do you ever worry that people are going to, I don't know, get interested in cannibalism for the wrong reason because of our social media and because of just people trying to, again, this word, sensationalize this stuff? And like I said, I know that you're probably like, I don't know how to answer this, but I that was kind of the thing that I thought of is, you know, you hear about these things. And like I said, in our culture recently, that it has really exploded. Like I said, with the exposure of Jeffrey Dahmer. And I just kind of wonder, you know, what that's going to do for cannibalism and what it is and the history of it and things like that. And are you going to get people that get into fetishes and weird stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think they would. I think that you'll probably have instances of that. Do I think that it'll be something that becomes popularized? And no, I don't think so. I enjoy a good shoot 'em up, but I'm not going out killing people with a firearm.
Right.
So, and that's blasted all over. You know, for me, before social media, it was, you know, it started with Bonnie and Clyde and the Wild Bunch in the late 1960s when I was a little kid, and I was like, wow, look at this slow motion, isn't that neat? And so we have this, you know, there I think there is a there's a real interest in blood and gore, whether it's vampires or cannibals, or but I think that for the most part, you know, people use it, you know, there's a filter that you mm-hmm. have, and you can look at the gory, creepy, scary things through this filter of either fictionalized stories or, well, that's, that guy's the psycho criminal, I would never do that, but ooh, that's kind of interesting.
Right. Could it open up a positive thing where people are more interested in maybe the historical, you know, aspect of things like this gore that they see?
On a personal level, I've found that most of the talk, and I've done hundreds of interviews now about cannibalism, a lot of it is that people want to be enlightened. You know, they want to know about the different types of animals that are involved in really kinds of strange behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, here are these little tiny spiderlings that wind up consuming their mother. Here's this legless amphibian. The babies hatch, and once they reach a certain size, they peel the skin off their mother to eat it. And the cannibalism, the perfectly natural history, the book that I wrote just goes on and on and on with all of these wild stories. And I think that, you know, there's been a real positive response to that type of thing, because there is this knee-jerk reaction when I say the word cannibalism. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's been that. And then there's this whole idea that I've been able to go out and promote, and that's how the word cannibalism, once it became a taboo, then, you know, then these flag planters, so-called explorers, if they dropped that word, then they could dehumanize any indigenous group they met. You know, if you were a cannibal, if Columbus says that you're a cannibal, then he doesn't have to treat you like a human, and he could just take or enslave you. And that happened, you know, that happened a lot. In the so-called age of discovery. And so that was the other thing that I've been
good
out there.
Point. Talking.
Yeah. So, that was something that took place in, you know, I went into it big time in the Caribbean, but it took place in Africa. It took place in South America as well, as Europeans went in there and just did whatever they wanted to do if they could dehumanize whoever they met. And that's what they did.
Right.
You know, Columbus came to the Caribbean. He was looking for gold. But he didn't find gold. The next most valuable thing he figured out were humans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And slavery, because that's how he paid for his trips. So, you know, that was something that I spent a lot of time trying to get out there and to get across.
Yeah, and it just kind of going back to what Chelsea was saying, as far as the education, your book can attract people who are generally interested in, you know, the animal kingdom and different behaviors of species, et cetera, but it can also attract people who maybe like horror movies or gore, right? But they walk away with something different and a little bit more enlightenment, like you said, and a little bit more education.
No, I completely. I mean, that's really my mantra. What you're talking about. That's something that is first and foremost with regard to what I do. It's the most important thing is to move away from this idea that of what cannibalism, what you think cannibalism is, to the reality of it, and to do it in a way that is entertaining and humorous. I mean, it's kind of weird to think, well, you wrote a book that had a lot of humor about cannibalism, but I think once again that's an offshoot of how I taught, and that was that if you stand there like a monologue for 45 minutes, then not everybody's going to be on their phone, and the old days it was like everyone's watching the clock. So if you can do things in an entertaining way, and with cannibalism you certainly had to pick your spots to inject humor, but it could be, I found that it could be done, and so it was just all part of this approach that I took, that I was fortunate to sort of find this avenue to go into a topic that most people thought about in a very different way.
Now, from all of your research, did you ever find a situation, an occurrence that happened kind of as an outlier that wasn't under the bell-shaped curve when it comes to cannibalism?
I mean, once again, if you go into criminal behavior or fetishistic behavior, then you can get into some really weird things that I just wasn't really interested in. I certainly recognized that they existed and I might have mentioned them, but I found really strange examples of it in the animal kingdom that I scratched my head about.
I was going to say, Bill, did you find any primarily herbivore species that partook in cannibalism, kind of like you were saying, in an infancy or in a birthing type of atmosphere that typically they eat, seaweed or grass or whatever. But in this instance. Yeah.
This happens a lot of times in insects, where you have the early stages of the insect will consume organic material that is not plant material. So they're either eating their other insects that hatch, or the dead. And if you're eating the same species, then to me that's a form of cannibalism.
Right.
So there was all sorts of that went on. But some of them your question, there are some species that cannibalize at certain early stages of their lives, and then when they are adults, they don't. They're completely herbivorous.
Yeah, that is very, very interesting. Because you would think kind of on a DNA level that they would instinctively, like carnivores are carnivores and herbivores are herbivores, like they're programmed, if you will, to be that way. So that's interesting that they kind of jump that line, but only...
The program is written that initially they are not herbivores, and then as they mature, the program changes. It's part of the developmental process. Huh. They're going through stages of their life that are quite different than humans. A lot of them are they go through metamorphosis. They have completely different forms when they're really small, and so they have a whole nother biology. They have a way of living than the adult form does. Right. You could look at caterpillars and butterflies, and there's a perfect example.
That is true.
If you came down to this planet and saw and looked at butterflies for the first time and caterpillars, would you put those together? No, completely different. So to me, the nature was endlessly fascinating, and there were some really, really wild examples. We have a type of shark. I lived on Long Island when I wrote this, the sand tiger shark. Mm-hmm. And the sand tiger shark is a shark that has a form of reproduction and development where the eggs are not laid. They hatch internally inside the mother's oviducts, and there are two. There's a right and a left oviduct, and the eggs are formed at different time period. You know, so they're, so some of the eggs are ready to hatch and others are sort of immature eggs, right? Well, the sharks that hatch first internally will start to consume their siblings, the eggs that are left, and even some of the hatchlings that form, so that, you know, a female shark may have, I don't know, I'm just picking a number here, may have 50 eggs, 25, let's say 25 on each side, but only two sharks emerge, one from each oviduct. And now they've literally been trained to be carnivores, to be hunters.
Wow.
I don't want to say in utero because there's no uterus, right. But that type of sibling cannibalism, I mean, I was blown away by that stuff.
Bill, so I'm going to loosely say as an educator, okay, as somebody who works in school systems and I have kids that are junior high ages, I selfishly am like, why are we not kind of teaching some of this? This is just really cool. And I think a lot of people would walk away from a biology class, even in a, you know, a junior high level, thinking like, this is so cool. And are you starting to see, like, are you starting to see that they're, you know, implementing some of this?
I don't know. The education system has really good points and has really bad points. I always harp on the fact that look at where the textbooks are coming out of. Look at where your textbook publishers are publishing and deciding what's going to go into textbooks. I won't go into it. I don't want to get into politics, but in my mind, it's not ideal. And then who is going through, sorting through these books and deciding what should or shouldn't be taught to students at any level? And you know, you're not. I think there are problems.
Yeah, that definitely was a double-edged question, because I agree with you. We could open up a whole can of worms as far as the education system, but from a personal standpoint, I am like, this is so cool. I can't wait to like read your work and have my kids read this stuff. You know, my daughter one of those, like, she's been watching. Who is that? Dr. Pohl? Is it Pohl or Polk? They have a show on
the veterinarian.
And she would watch this stuff from the time she was little bitty, and they would, you know, live stream almost a lot of the surgeries that they would have to do on these animals. And I remember my mom asked her one time, she was like, Inslee, does that kind of gross you out a little bit? And she said, well, Mom, if I want to be a vet, I better get used to gross stuff. And I just was like, that's so cool. So I'm so excited to have books like that I can share with my kids who are interested in this stuff.
And I'm working on a young reader's version of cannibalism. I'm thinking that will be that quite possibly might be my next project.
Please do.
Yeah, I've just got to get my my publisher to agree with that. I definitely think there's a place for that type of book for kids. Same thing with the blood feeding on a lesser scale, but certainly cannibalism with all of the interesting animals, and getting away from what they'll soon be thinking every time they hear the word cannibalism. If we can get something else in that I think that'll be beneficial.
Well, and I think it's so important because I am a therapist, and so I mostly specialize in trauma and addiction. And kind of more specifically, I also specialize in sex addiction. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, as you were talking, I had, you know, my brain was just kind of spinning, and I was thinking that part of the only reason that I feel like things like cannibalism in this case is so, same word, sensationalized, is because it's the emotion that's attached to it without the proper education. And so, like, when I work with somebody in treatment for sex addiction, just as an example, one of the common themes that I see is the feelings of excitement and shame that intertwine, that happens simultaneously when there's a sexual experience early on. And so one of the things that we say is neurons that fire together wire together. And so from that point, from that experience, that individual, when there is taboo sexual behavior, there is now arousal from a nervous system standpoint, right, and physiological standpoint. And that's just a really long-winded connecting the dots. I'm trying to get you guys to see kind of where my brain is going and why I think it's so important, because if these kids learn about cannibalism, right, from Dr. Bill Shutt's book, and we talk about it from a quote-unquote normalized sense, and you prioritize feeling all like these normal array of emotions, then it really takes away the stigma, which then takes away this preoccupation, obsession with dark, gritty things. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely. You know, that sounds like it that what you just said would fit in perfectly to a proposal about writing a book for young readers about cannibalism. I mean, that's a key reason why you'd want to do that, I think.
Yeah. Awesome.
Man, every episode I try to tell myself that I'm not going to just get really overwhelmed and then be just like, I'm having to process all of this awesomeness. And here I am. I hope this doesn't embarrass you, but I am so glad that we are able to talk to you. Like, I really did not know what to expect.
Sure.
With this idea of cannibalism. I mean, I feel like Bailey and I try to stay open-minded, you know, and she was like, we're going to have this, you know, zoologist. And am I saying that correctly? You are a zoologist first,
yep.
Right? And I was just kind of like, cool, whatever. And then now I'm over here like, can I subscribe to all of your books? Like, can I go to school to be a cannibal professor as well? Like, you
cannibal professor.
Well, cannibologist.
Cannibologist.
Can you create that so I can study under you? Like, this is just absolutely amazing and fascinating. And I guess, you know, I tell Bailey the one thing that I have wanted, and I've found that I really enjoy asking in these interviews, is if there is one thing that you wish people would either ask you or you wish people would know, and I know that's a hard question, what do you think that would be, where you're like, I just really wish when people interviewed me, they would ask me this, or they would let me talk about this?
I think we've certainly covered all of those things, which is, I think that's been pretty clear. And just allowing me to demystify something that you may have had a long-held belief or a knee-jerk reaction to, that is, with the topic being something borderline weird,
mm-hmm.
That really has explanations that go far beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
It's... You know, you look at cannibalism and you've got, oh, it's crime. It's like, oh, it's gore. It's Jeffrey Dahmer. And here I am able to go, no, look at all these cool animals and look at what they're doing. And look at, and you know, even among humans, it's, to me, a main theme of my book, the half of it that dealt with humans is that culture is king. And it's what a society determines mm-hmm. is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. So that may have been the most important point there. You know, you had anthropologists who went into South America and they came across a tribe called the Waray, and the Waray consumed their dead.
Mm-hmm.
And anthropologists were like, what? You consume your dead? You eat your dead? You can't eat your dead. And the Waray went, well, what do you do with your dead? Of course, I'm
paraphrasing, right.
And the anthropologists were like, well, we bury them. And the Waray were mortified. They were like, why would you put your dead loved ones in the ground to be eaten by worms. Why wouldn't you incorporate them into yourselves and share them among your family and loved ones so that they could be part of you for as long as you're alive? And the anthropologist said, yeah, but you can't eat people. And so that became, you know, that was an issue, not just in South America. That became, you know, that was in places like New Guinea, which is a very different story with a very different ending, where we're consuming people during funerary rites led to thousands of people dying from kura, from this disease that was transmitted from eating nervous tissue, brain matter. So there was so much interesting stuff there, but a lot of it simply had to do with the fact that, you know, if you didn't get the memo from Homer and the people who wrote the fairy tales and Sigmund Freud that cannibalism was this horrible thing, then you might have another belief about that. And it you know, once the West, which is so dominant and had such far-reaching ability to move into other cultures, oftentimes destroying them, you know, once that happened, then these people sort of wisened up and either performed the rites that they've been performing for hundreds and maybe thousands of years out of the sight of the, you know, the guys who showed up with the t-shirts, or they stopped doing it because they didn't want to get persecuted. They didn't want to get hassled. They didn't want to get killed. So I think that that not a lot of it goes on now. Probably starvation, cannibalism being that's about it. That'd be about it. That and a bit of medicinal cannibalism. But you really don't, as far as being a widespread custom, I don't think you see it much anymore. That's why you have the realm of the crazies and criminal cannibalism that sort of steps to the fore, and that's what everybody's talking about. It's, oh, what movie star decided he wanted to talk about cannibalism, or you know, that sexy looking guy's in this movie about cannibalism. You know, that's what everybody's seeing. You know, they're not learning about cultures where that was something sacred that you did, or you know, they're not learning about how it takes place in the animal kingdom. So that's why I think that's why the sensationalism remains.
And it's interesting because I hear that there's much more of a Venn diagram between your side of cannibalism, if you will, and true crime. Kind of what came first, the chicken or the egg? It sounds like, you know, Western societal pressures, or what do they call it when they set something and you have to go by that? Like a precedent or a declaration of moving away from cannibalism, you know, or persecuting people or cultures or communities that engaged in cannibalism is kind of, and it's in a really kind of ironic twist, true crime in and of itself. Right?
I also think that it is not very common, but when you hear about it, you freak out and are attracted to that story. Mm-hmm. The amount of criminal cannibalism that takes place, I don't think is, you know, I can't give you numbers, but I don't think it's very common. It's just that when you hear about it, you're intrigued, you're turned on. And, you know, once again, taboo plus food equals fascination. So I think that I'm not so sure. I'd really doubt that there's, you know, all of a sudden there's more criminal cannibalism taking place. I couldn't, and I can't tell you the numbers. I'm not, you know, I don't study that aspect of this phenomenon. But, you know, to me, it's not something that I've been running into more and more now that, you know, it's just, you know, to me, it's just more, it's sensationalism, and it's what sells, you know, books or movie tickets, and you know, what show on TV you're going to watch because they got this story about this guy who is into whatever.
Well, I personally am hoping that because of the popularity of this word cannibalism, and we're hearing it and we're seeing it, I really am hoping that this is going to open a door for you, you and people, hopefully more people like you who are like, hey, since we're talking about it, let's talk about it correctly. Let's talk about it in an educational, let's talk about it in a, in a more positive and more productive, just something that's actually going to produce something other than, like Bailey always says, a saturated nervous system. You know, let's do something good with this since it is a hot topic.
Yeah. And I, as I said, I've got 7 books that I've done now. And as far as the media attention, the blogs, radio, TV interviews, reviews, magazines writing stories about it, having me write stuff, there's no comparison between what's come out of this book, Cannibalism, and all my other stuff combined. It's not even a tenth of it. There's been interest in my books, and I've been really happy with going to conferences and going to libraries and schools and talking about the heart, or soon it's going to be about teeth. And I think that becomes interesting, because then you get into the history of this, and you can talk about early dental care, and you can talk about teeth as fossils, and you can talk about new medical breakthroughs, using the, looking at the bacteria that are found on common gum bacteria as possibly a cause of Alzheimer's. It's all of that is there. So, and the potential is there for me to go do more of the same thing that I've been doing with Cannibalism. I'm out there doing it, and I know that there are other people who are scientist types who are really interested in taking ideas and breaking them down and getting rid of the jargon and allowing people who are non-scientists to understand what the hell we're talking about. Oftentimes it is uphill. It's like you're pushing a stone uphill a lot of times to get to the point where, you're getting beyond the knee jerk. You're getting beyond the sort of that instant attraction to the sensationalized aspects of whatever topic you're talking about. And I'm not complaining because those are the topics that I chose. Yeah. I chose to write about blood feeding, and I chose to write about cannibalism. I chose to look at some of the torturous techniques that were involved in early dental. Want to call it dental care, tooth transplants, early dentures, the whole controversy with George Washington's teeth, all of that. It's neat that I'm really lucky that I get to go in and kind of tell those stories, and by doing so, educate about other things. Now, here are the basics about your teeth. Here's what you shouldn't be doing. Here's when the trouble started, back when they started to refine sugar. They gave you mercury to treat toughness, and now your teeth fell out when you were president.
Oh, this makes me so happy. I'm so excited for this. Oh, I'm so, because people think dentistry is so boring and teeth are so boring. Oh, no. And I am over here like, I'm so excited. They're so cool, guys. There's over 300 different types of bacteria that we know about. And that's just what we know about. And they're pooping in your mouth. And that's why you have to eat it.
And it was kind of the same doing the heart, although the fact that I was not a cardiologist, I did some work when I was a scientist, that I used to work as a contractor at the EPA, but I was not really trained as a cardiologist. So then I looked more at the historical aspects of it, and then looked at it through the book that is out, my more recent book, looked at some weird stuff like the largest heart in the world, and they pulled it out of this dead blue whale that washed up in Canada and they wanted to get it out before the whale exploded from the gases that were built up inside of it. So there's an icky story, but you get to talk about aspects of biology because you're dealing with this specific thing that people are interested in immediately, like, oh, the biggest heart in the world? What's the story behind that? So then you get to talk about well, you know, if it was a hummingbird, its heart would be 6 times bigger than that whale heart. And you get to explain why that's so. So I've been lucky to find this niche, it keeps me off the streets. You know, I retired, but in the middle of the pandemic, I took an early retirement and it worked out really well. And I get to do this. So now I don't have 2 full-time jobs. I just write.
Well, we're glad for it, because if you didn't do this, we wouldn't have had the honor and the pleasure of sitting down and talking with you about this. And
this turned out a treat. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you for coming on and giving us your time. And just for our listeners, for where can they find all of your books? I know, like, they can probably Google it, go to Amazon, but is it on your website?
Yeah, I mean, billschutt.com. Plus all my books are still in press, which is kind of great. And so you can get them or order them wherever books are sold, on Amazon or Barnes and Noble or wherever. I did a Facebook post. It's like, oh, the first time I saw the cover of Bite, which is an incisive history of teeth from hagfish to humans, is the title, was in Target. So but it's coming out in the summer. It could be pre-ordered now, but it's my books. If you just look up my name and books, something will show
up. And we're going to link everything in our show notes, so people can just click on it. It'll go straight to your website and straight to, like, Amazon or something.
And if you give me the link for this show, I'll put it up on my website and also whatever other social media pages.
Thank you. We would appreciate that. Well, Dr. Bill, listen, this has been one of the most fun interviews that we've had.
I genuinely have not laughed at a story that hard in a really long time. Like, I think stuff is funny generally. I have not laughed.
But not that funny. She doesn't laugh that. She really doesn't.
I really don't.
And you muted your mic for literally probably 5 solid minutes. She was just hysterically, she was just buckled over, crying, laughing.
That has got to be a top 5 story of all time. So whether you intended that to be someone's top 5 story or not, you can add that to your resume. You can add that to your repertoire. If you're like, it is Chelsea's top. This is my top 5 story for another human being. So that's part of why you should write my books or read my books and publish my books. Because
thanks. Yeah, I mean, the chapter became, I titled the chapter Placenta Helper.
Oh.
It was probably in all of the books I've ever written, as far as like major cool experiences go, and I've had a bunch of them. The Donner party with the dog that there's this thing now. Oh, you know, they think they found Amelia Earhart's plane. I don't think it's going to turn out. I think that her plane was ditched in the water much closer to an atoll than where they're seeing this the image. I'd be really surprised if it's Amelia Earhart's plane, but the part of the story that I dealt with was in writing the cannibalism book. The dog, the historical human remains detecting dog that I worked with, and the researchers, Kaylee, this beautiful border collie, was the dog that also we think or her handlers and owner think. They discovered the remains, or at least some type of remains of Amelia Earhart on this atoll, and so that was to go out there and work with the Donner Party researchers and have this dog there was just that whole story turned out to be almost as cool, I think, as the placentas in Plano.
Well, if your books are how you tell stories, then I cannot. Wait, I cannot wait, and I am so excited. I'm so excited.
Good.
So, thank you times a million.
You're the best. And thank you for sharing it with us.
The best.
Talk to you about Steve in the future, hopefully.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And on that note, thank you very much. And yeah, this was fun.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, Wildside Tribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast. Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's Wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below. As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.